Hey again, this is John Harmon for the Sports Medicine Broadcast. I'm here with Jay and Ray. Y'all could be a morning talk show, like Sports Medicine Radio.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, shake and bake.
From the south and from the east, I guess.
Yes, you know, like Talladega Nights, a little bit better with shake and bake.
So, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Okay, well, I'm Ray Castle. I'm a professor and athletic training program director at Louisiana State University, and I've asked Jay Sidori to come along. So, Jay, give a little bit about yourself.
My name is Jay Sidori. I'm a certified athletic trainer for the United States Marine Corps in Quantico, Virginia. I primarily work with the basic school and the force fitness program. I'm also an adjunct professor at George Mason University, so I try to keep my hands in just a little bit with education. I do the best I can.
Keeping busy.
At least.
And having fun. That's the main thing.
We got to make athletic training fun again.
Oh, it is. Athletic training is always fun.
Absolutely.
It's how you make a light of it every day. So have some fun and go to play every day. So, Jay, not Ray, but Jay, what is a fun fact about Jay that otherwise somebody doesn't know listening to the podcast?
Wow, fun facts. I don't know I have many fun facts. I played volleyball in high school in Arizona. I played in college as well. So it's a little bit of a fun fact, I guess.
Were you good?
That's debatable. That's
okay.
Debatable.
But, relative, I guess.
Yeah, it's all relative. I did well enough to play and earn some playing time. So.
Okay. Well, cool. We're, go ahead. Oh, I thought I listened to background noise and things like that.
Lots of background.
Okay, Jay, I'm going to give you the mic for a second so you can fire a question. I threw a curveball at you.
Yeah, well, actually, Ray, what I want to talk to you about today, maybe hit me up a little bit on kind of what are you doing with emergency care now? You're pretty well known as far as large event coverage. And just tell me a little bit about how you're teaching emergency care and kind of where that's going for you and LSU and your other projects.
Okay, well, I do a lot of, in addition to doing my role at LSU, we do, you know, in doing some coverage there. We also do a good bit of coverage out in large-scale events like the Louisiana Marathon, the Mississippi Gulf Coast Marathon. I go up to Boston every year doing the Boston Marathon, doing existing medical coverage there, and doing triathlons and other events as well. And, you know, looking at where what we're doing from an emergency care standpoint, really trying to bring in, making sure, obviously from a program standpoint, that we're bringing in best practices, what's happening in the larger context. And athletic trainers do work in the larger context. It's not just a sport field. It's within, you know, when the national incident management system and emergency systems and looking at how that training goes in, what EMS does. And we're a player within that. And making sure that, you know, that's what I view our role as a critical incident response. So
what are the bigger challenges you find with working with large events? So I think we've all worked, like a football game, track meet, fairly large events, lots of unknown people. But, you know, for the most part, probably schools that we're familiar with. What are some challenges that you've experienced in that type of large event, like golf tournaments or marathon events and so on?
I think it's, you know, and I've covered, like for example, I jokingly say I've covered football games out in the middle of a cane field in South Louisiana,
okay,
where the closest hospital is 30 miles. And, you know, it's no different than you having a large-scale event, and the common denominator is making sure you have good communication. That's the first thing. You make have a viable lines of communication. Know that wherever you are, you're stepping into that from a – they know what your role is, you know what your role is, and then also from, you know, going into that, so we do that all the time. So, for example, you know, the medical timeout is that transcends any type of event where you're going to have medical coverage there, and where just have that conversation so that, you know, if you're with EMS at a high school game or a soccer match, you know, this is what we're doing. I'm here. How are you doing? This is what our capabilities are, what we have on site. You're here. I need to know if you're going to leave or not. That with some of the EMS.
So is that in your pre-planning then? So as far as working with EMS, so you know, I don't know how many events you've done, but at the end of the day, I'm sure your EMS crews are critically important to getting your patients to where they need to be at the end of the day.
Right.
So what are some best practices that you've done to coordinate, whether call the service or is it usually volunteer service?
I think that we use a lot of, like for the larger scale events, I think the first thing to recognize is that there's other things going on besides that event. So if there is, you know, in Louisiana, in Baton Rouge area, we have a lot of plants. So if there's a plant explosion, things are getting diverted to there. It's
sure.
A critical incident response.
Right.
Or there's a major accident on, you know, or a mass casualty, you know, like 2 weeks ago, You saw our representative, Steve Scalise, who was members of the Congress that were shot on a baseball field. It's just the context. It's not a senator. It's somebody who it can happen anywhere. Right. But in this case, it's not the first time something's happened on a baseball field. So you have to understand that there's a bigger – we're part of a bigger picture. And where you're prepared for that communication, have a right equipment there. And right now, you know, the context is it's pretty simple that we have now. Obviously, we have AEDs that are in place. We have also, depending on other equipment you may need, like, you know, for marathons, we've got to have heat-related, you know, management type of things, like, you know, having cold tubs and using colorectal thermometer measurement as a gold standard. You can – it doesn't mean using a thermistor. People think, oh, I got to use a, you know, you use that. You can have a regular, you know, an oral thermometer that can be used as that if you need to. Having backup plans with that, it could be, you know, the other more higher end digital. It just means you're going to, how are you going to do that? And then the last one is really important is having bleeding control. And if you can handle those things are like a tourniquets and hemostatic agents. So that's come down the line. And I like to refer to it, you know, like working those vents that have, you're having a heat related illness component. You know, those are three things you have to deal with: heat, you have to deal with cardiac events, and you're dealing with bleeding control. And you can pretty much handle pretty much anything if you know the communication line. So I like to commonly jokingly say there are three types of AEDs. One is obviously for the heart, and that's statistically shown. That's the one way you're definitely going to revive somebody, no matter what, you know, any manual compressions do or resuscitation things you do. Then you have tourniquets, hemostatic agents, and we know that it's very well proven in throughout, you know, military and civilian. In your experience, I know you see a lot of that in the military side, sure, where the evidence is there. It's clear cut that you save lives from that. It could be a fracture, it could be athlete fall, you know, having a severe gash, you know, falling on equipment. Those are still bleeding, and they're going to die if you don't control that. And then the last AED is, you know, I think you look at the using colorectal thermometer use. And that's the only one that's going to save your butt. You know, joking to say that. So, yeah, literally. So you have three of those things. You know, you prepare that. But communication is really big. And working collaboratively with a lot of different folks and knowing what the – especially big scale races or events, or it could be a big tournament. It's all the same thing.
So do you think that most athletic trainers are up to date with tourniquets, hemostatic agents, you know, chest seals? And so I kind of leave that question because I just came back from the Far West Conference, doing a nice little, you know, practical lab and also lecture there. And I felt like it was a good turnout, but, you know, the common feedback that I got was that, you know, these are things and skills that I'm just not familiar with or comfortable with, which is totally fair. Yeah. And I think, only recently implemented that in our educations across the board. So just like maybe using other things, like maybe core temperature, some of us have to catch up a little bit to that, to that training.
I think some of the, you know, you mentioned like having a chest seal or other, or you're having interosseous access. Those are things I know that you're familiar with and other athlete trainers that work in tactical emergency combat care, or they're trained there, TECC. The brother to that or sister is tactical casualty combat care, which is a military setting.
Sure.
And there's only about five or six skills that, in my research in that, five or six, and you can probably elaborate more, that we're not trained in already, but those are – it's for unique situations. So you're not, you know, you're having, but being able to do control bleeding, hemostatic agents, you can control bleeding. And whether it be, you know, having, understanding what, you know, pneumothorax occurs or having those type of sanguinating trauma, but you're having to you look at that context of where you are. I think there's a skill gap. And it's not a question of our colleagues wanting to know it. It's just getting that actual training. And it's very simple training. And it's, you know, and also the Stop the Bleed initiative is really great because you go to an easy learning session and you're the skill component, and then you can become the instructor for your school. It's a lot of things that go on outside of athletics that can happen. You know, car accidents and things like that, or falling off a playground, having a compound fracture, or anything else could happen, or falling on a object. So it's really day-to-day activities, and that's what came through with the Harper consensus, and the NATA was an important working group member of that. Jim Thornton went there a couple of years ago when they first started in 2013. Our association was invited to have representation there, and I think that's going to continue. It's going to be one of the bigger things that we've got to move in forward to, because the reality is, as we saw, you know, it's going to happen. You know, a stand's collapsing. How are you going to manage that? you're gonna be asked to do things, probably some extraordinary things, you know, that you saw, you know, that unfortunately that myself and some of the colleagues at the Boston Marathon were required to do that we weren't prepared to do, period, because we don't see that. That's something you see overseas, in a forward front military setting versus things you may see. But the reality is it can happen. It could be a bomb explosion in a plant. We have athletic trainers work there. We have athletic trainers that work, a car accident. Those are things that all can happen at any given time. So just being prepared and having a plan of action.
I think the next step we don't maybe not think about, you know, I mean, how many different brands or types of tape are there? How many brands, types of liquid, electrolyte tablets are there? You know, there's about five or six common tourniquets, hemostatic agents. So I think once we're, comfortable and familiar with, controlling bleeding, it's also going to, from my clinic to your clinic, knowing how to use that specific type of commercial product.
Right.
And those commercial products are actually, I say they're changing all the time, but they are in evolutions. You know, there's other things that are out there that, they're trying to experiment with. And I think at the end of the day, people can fashion a tourniquet, but we know that there's different types of tourniquets out there that might need a little more education, training, and practice.
Yeah.
Because the first time you use that tourniquet, hopefully it's not at a stressful situation where you really need to. And that would be really unfortunate if the first time you saw a tourniquet is when you actually needed to use it.
Yeah. And I've been there, and it's definitely you're usually equipped for something, and it's just basic core equipment that every athlete trainer should have in a trauma medical kit is having hemostat. The idea is you never want to use them. That's the idea. It's just no different than anything else.
But you're spending,
you could have one, a commercial tourniquet, and those are the most proven, reliable types. There are a number of different types. I know you're familiar with them because you see them in the military and there's some other types like junctional tourniquets, which you're going to use them for the pelvic region.
Sure.
Or some other ones, but you having, the longer strap, like either a soft tee or a cat or combat application tourniquet, those that have the windlass, those are the two most reliable. We've seen that from the literature. And I think the other thing is, and I know you've seen it more than in your setting, that you're going to cause an intense amount of pain, but pain is irrelevant to the situation. I've worked with some of the simulators, and the amazing force you have to crank down to actually occlude an artery to stop bleeding. And once you do that, then you give the person a chance to live.
Right. It is quite impressive how much pressure you have to keep on a wound to occlude that wound, especially with hemostatic agents where you have to keep pressure on for, 1 to 2 minutes.
So what do you see? I know you're taught with the Marine Corps and your peers there that are out in the come back in the field. How long typically could you leave a tourniquet on without causing any reputable? I mean, I've heard it correct like 4 to 6 hours without having any damage at all, permanent damage.
Sure. And I think it obviously depends on the wound type. It depends if it's a complete amputation, if there's a retraction of the arteries, there's a lot of factors in there as well. Do they have advanced care? Are they being heloed out?
Yeah.
But essentially, we're looking between, 3 to 4 hours to be safely transported. And I think those transport times in combat are shrinking. We're looking more like conventional EMS. If we were here in the convention center, we call it EMS, we're talking a few minutes of a response. And not as quick in theater, but, we're getting closer with all the things that we have. And I think things that have been saving is those skills, those basic skills. And so we've heard the term BLS saves lives, right?
Yeah.
So you can have the high-speed medic with all the equipment, but at the end of the day, it's those basic skills that actually save lives.
Yeah, and being equipped to have those things, and even now we're seeing that what's being done in the military setting, police officers are using that, EMS is using it, other emergency, even they're emphasizing the bystander being, take action, and that's probably one of the big things. No one takes action. You're calling 911 or doing something in a very critical, just being able to control the bleeding and having access to that type of equipment. And
so, are you teaching those skills on a large basis besides your students at LSU, or how are you implementing that in your community?
Yeah, we'll do that. I've been involved. I've been a couple courses. And I know that I went to one course, and it was in Jacksonville, the Jacksonville Sports Medicine Program. I went in April. And I know that was one course. I was teaching another lab on cold water immersion techniques using core rectal thermometer, taking core rectal measurements and using that. And really, from a scenario base, how do you handle a combative patient? You know, I know you and I both worked up at Boston, and you're looking at a person. I'm gonna go off tangent for a second. The person is 106 core body temp.
Yep.
And at the rates we see up to 110. It's not uncommon 108, 109.
Right.
That's just over the mark of being at a heat stroke. But you have three people. One person walks in. They're there, and they are, for the most part, catatonic. And you put them in an ice bath, and they barely flinch. You have the next person who's screaming, just wanting to be combative, biting you, wanting to bite you, trying to get at you. You have eight or nine people doing rapid life-saving measures, and they're the same one. And then the other person, he or she's in the tub, and they're joking, you know, hey, how's it going? You know, what's my temperature? And you hear somebody says, oh, this happened. You hear what the guy says, 105.7. That's cool. I'm like, no, it's not cool. You know, it's not, you know, so you have that, but you're looking at, or from a teaching standpoint, but they were doing some of that. They did that. They have the simulators using hemostatic agents and also tourniquet simulators, really easy to get. And, you know, EMS, that you're all groups, you can easily go out and learn these skills in 20, 30 minutes. It's really that simple to use. We're doing an emergency, LSU is doing our second year, we're doing an emergency preparation athletics course. And this course really started last year, really kind of the genesis. I give props to Ron Corson at Georgia, that Devon Gales, who was the athlete who had the catastrophic neck injury there at Southern University, and Southern University's in Baton Rouge. So getting together with Lovey Tabron, who's director of sports medicine at Southern, and Ron and Devon, he's doing fantastic. I mean, I think he's a testament to that, because the things that in the last month or so, he's starting to show signs of progress of being able to have some mobility to walk, and otherwise he was a paraplegic. And I think that's what's impactful, the quality of life you can make in somebody, whether it be bleeding, whether it be heat stroke, or whatever the serious injury may be, is being prepared to handle those things. So we're doing the emergency care course. We're bringing a lot of simulation equipment in. We're actually bringing in some of the groups are bringing in live simulators they use in the military, and then you can bleeding control. So you got the participants there will be able to, we have about 150, 160 that are coming in. We use it as a public service event. It's a free course for anybody, physicians, EMS, sign up. I'll just show up, and we'll have bleeding control as a lab. We're using tourniquets as a lab. We've got some great speakers. You know, obviously Ron Corson, Glenn Henry, they're doing some cardiac conditions. Mike Kordecki, who created the ripcord with the shoulder pads, are coming in. Mary Beth Hordisky, Dr. Hordisky's coming in. We've got a lot of different, you know, equipment removal. EMS is very intercollaborative, skill-based. So those are the types of things I think that people are really enjoying. They need more. They understand it. They just need to get hands-on. And that's where the skill gap is, I think, for a lot of this, is just not being able to practice it so they know how to use it. And it's as simple as it is. You need to have somebody to go out and spend 30 minutes, train your staff, train your coaches, or your high school or whatever, or your employees, and know how to use that. And these are free services that are offered throughout any community in the country. And it's a very standardized program, the Stop the Bleed Initiative.
And I think that's really important. You're providing that, that serves the education. So, you know, we're here at, you know, NATA symposium here, and it's all about education, right? Getting your CEUs, getting better at our skills. And, you know, I think when we think about education and our skills, we think about, you know, a lot of lecture, you know, a lab that might include some movement, maybe, you know, some demonstration. But, you know, I'm going to venture to say that the most athletic trainers have not had the opportunity to go do emergency skills scenario-based training, meaning that they're going to walk into a room, take care of this patient in an emergency care type of scenario. I'm going to go out on a limb and say probably, you know, 80% of athletic trainers haven't really done that since maybe undergrad or graduate school, yeah, in their advanced first aid or basic medic class, whatever they may call it. So I think what you're doing at LSU and providing those services is a great opportunity for us, and I would, I guess, encourage any athletic trainer out there to, you know, give them this is an opportunity to work with EMS, an opportunity to work with, you know, SWAT teams and all these other great, or even their local military assets, and again, just leveraging that expertise.
Yeah, I think, you know, we have, every community has EMS, and they're good at what they do. They follow protocol-driven care. It's very simple. I mean, they have those skills that do that, and they want to make it. They want to make improved care as well. It improves a patient's survivability, whether it be from a car accident or whoever it may be. And I think those are the. I think I have to. I I agree with you on that about the knowledge gap. And I think probably because it's still new, you know, we have a philosophical, like for tourniquets, there's a huge mindset, oh, tourniquets are bad, and over triage and how you use that. And that, and going for years, we, you know, used them up to the early 80s, went away with them in first aid CPR training. And now you're trying to get back into that. But now, you know, curriculums for the athletic training, they're teaching this. This is a core skill set that they're teaching in the program. So you have the younger generation. I've seen a couple of courses like the one I've mentioned, and we'll have a younger generation sees this. They've already had experience just like, you know, core rectal thermometer use, some other things, versus you have the older, they either some have it, some have not. So you're seeing a very rapid compression or reduction in that number. I think as more people get those courses, they're seeing the how impactful it is. And emergency care is the most critical point we do, period. I mean, that's a, you know, it doesn't matter what else we do, you know, as long as you're, whether it be a head, recognizing a head trauma, or, you know, being that, being able to be the pre-hospital provider that we're trained to be. And this is just a one, it's more of a rapid, more of a prerequisite or compulsory skill equipment base that every trauma kit should have. So having a, you know, the checklist, it's very critical. I think you know when you have that equipment, make sure it's up to date, make sure it hadn't been used, you know, whether it be, you know, the batteries for AEDs, have a method in place and document that. And that's just make sure, it's just like having bloodborne pathogens. It's I'm relying on you, Jay, that I may not know you, but I'm working on it, and you're going to do the right thing. And you're typing trust that I'm going to do the right thing. But you have to have that documented.
Absolutely.
That you have all those in gear. So
absolutely.
With that.
If I could interject here for a second. So as the lone representative of secondary school athletic trainers here on this panel, you all are the panel, and I'm just pushing buttons here. Being an athletic trainer in the state of Texas, obviously, we should have a good interpersonal relationship with our local EMS. At Dickinson High School, I can tell you we have a great relationship. Derek Hunt's director of EMS in our community. We meet with him on a multi times a year, so that we can make sure that he's on board with what we're wanting to do differently, as well as the opposite. Would you advise athletic trainers in the state of Texas, if they're interested in learning more about emergency medicine, that needs to be their first call, is to call their local EMS and say, I need to brush up, I need to get more information.
Yeah, there's that. There's also you can go on the web, look at stopthebleed.org. That is you can find where providers are. That's a national directive that came out, that started in 2013. So, and really it's implementing life-saving measures to the bystanders and all healthcare providers. So that's one. But EMS is the first one. Hey, where can I learn this skill base? We're trained in wound care. Just a matter of finding that, or find another group that would have that. You know, I know in Texas, you know, you may even use, like, is it? I don't know if an example, maybe Texar, like the search and rescue group. I'm familiar with that group. They may have training in that as well. Because they're doing a lot of rescue type of operations. I think as a nonprofit, I believe, is that correct? That they volunteer work. And actually, I know one athletic trainer who's involved with that. We were talking about yesterday, Mark Bowling, who's down at Corpus Christi. He's an athletic trainer at the university there. So he's involved in that. So their athletic trainers are involved in this a lot, or finding someone, or emergency room physicians, or even like reaching out to National Guard, for example, or fire department. That may be enough. I mean, that's pretty good, you think?
Absolutely. I would just echo that and say that they will also have some of the equipment and some of the training materials that they can lend you and work with you. So, you know, I can't speak, you know, in the state of Texas, but in Virginia, you know, they have monthly training cycles for their EMS providers. And whether it's at their station or another station or in the same county, there's constantly training going on. And I find that's just another opportunity to come to the table and share some knowledge and say, hey, this is what I would do different, or this is what we have available to us. And again, they're going to be well resourced, and those are going to be the providers you're going to be working with primarily. So I absolutely encourage that. It'd be my first shot.
Yeah. Using same equipment. I mean, hey, what equipment do you recommend? So now if they're coming on site, then, you know, will your school district, or have you had this? Okay. EMS uses this. Okay, this is that way. You know, there's not a changing knowledge gap. You're adopting their protocols, and they have they're pretty straightforward. I mean, I think on how they're going to handle X, Y, Z, and you have the same equipment or similar equipment, and again, like bleeding control equipment is not expensive. I mean, what some of the commercial tourniquets run, the extremity tourniquets run probably $20 to $30 for each one. You want to have at least two because if you're usually putting one, if you have uncontrolled bleeding and the first one doesn't work, you put a next recommend to put one adjacent to it and put both of the tighten both of those down. That should include the bleeding in addition to the hemostatic agent. So, you know, that's normally what's, you know, having multiple, have a plan A and plan B. If plan A is one tourniquet doesn't work, have a plan B too, or you have, the, you know, different ones that may be in the place, or, and you can buy the kits as well for schools, and it's just like an AED with that.
Well, this broadcast will go, I mean, theoretically it'll go worldwide because it's just going on the internet, you know, but we have a broad base of secondary school athletic trainers in this local area because this is where we're based out of.
Yep.
This is where Jeremy's broadcast is based out of. He just asked me to help for the day.
Oh,
so
yeah.
That's why I'm here. But we'll have plenty of high school athletic trainers from the large 6A level all the way down to, you know, realistically 3A is the smallest classification that could employ, that really would employ a standalone athletic trainer. At these smaller schools or these West Texas schools or schools down in the valley, we may not even have access to EMS services within a 10 to 15 minute time frame. Really, they're the ones who need this type of training as much as anybody.
You know, I would beg to differ. It's just, it's equal. Because I know in Baton Rouge, we have a metropolitan, you know, an area of like 250,000. At any given time, we have only 8 units that are active. 8. That's all. And you think of all the, you know, with all the plants going on, things like this, and everything that goes on in the world, I mean, in our world there, and we've had situations where we had EMS, it takes 20, 30 minutes. You know, and then on top of that, we had a one of our hospitals shut down a year or so ago, so emergency rooms. So that time delay can easily be 30 minutes. And, you know, it's no different. You may have to be there person for 30, 40 minutes where somebody does it, and you're giving them a chance to live. So with that. So it's okay. I want to change gear. I want to hear what you're doing because that's – Jay is, you're now with the Marine Corps and you're doing the force fitness program. Is that correct?
Yeah,
I've seen a lot of the stuff you're doing and really innovative what an athletic trainer does and the role in a military setting. And if you can kind of explain a little bit what you're doing there, and we'll ask some questions.
I'm really fortunate, really, really blessed to have the opportunity to be in that position. And so kind of where the idea came from is a commandant of the Marine Corps looked across the Marine Corps and we have trainers for everything. You know, shooting instructors, trainers how to do tactics, martial arts types of things, but we never had a physical fitness instructor or trainer. And he looked across the pond to our Royal Marines, and they have a specialty job, that their whole job is to teach training, prevention, rehabilitation to their force. And so his vision was to create something of the sort for the Marine Corps. And despite being, you know, probably the most fit service, if you will, of all the services, we felt that we could do better with that. We could train better, stronger, and not potentially get hurt through that. So the Force Fitness Program is a 6-week program. It's a secondary job or a secondary MOS. And so we have Marines coming from all over to essentially get 3 parts: nutrition, training, strength training, conditioning, and injury prevention. And so the command, the director, the basic school commanding officer, all these people foresaw that athletic trainers have a huge value to the Marines. And we need to impart that knowledge, not just for training centers and entry-level places, but it needs to be across the entire Marine Corps. Now, ideally, yes, we'd love to hire athletic trainers at each base, every post, every command. We'd love to hire a strength coach at every post, every branch, every command. And it's not feasible, it's not possible. But what we can do is teach them some concepts, right? Just like we're teaching our coaches. So, you know, as you start up your school, you know, you're doing first aid training. You're talking to them, the things to look out for. Maybe some of the, you know, either supplements to be aware of. And so we're kind of taking the same thing of trying to train our Marines to be better and smarter at different things. So, you know, they're getting a little bit of anatomy, a little bit of kinesiology, a little bit of common injuries, things they might see that they could help prevent, you know. So, you know, we also have some correctives in there. So one of the things we're really not good at is movement, quality of movement. These guys are wearing boots all the time. These guys are wearing heavy, heavy packs. So typical things, bad shoulders, locked up thoracic spine, low back pain, maybe some knee pain, ankles, really poor dorsiflexion, real poor movement. So we're integrating a system in more of a template. It's not going to fit everybody, but it's a really good place to start. So, you know, we're going to have some corrective exercises. We're going to make sure that they understand progression and cycles and making sure that they understand how to put together a large program for a small group and a big group and do it safely. So that's less people coming to me. That's true prevention. We know that the stronger the Marine, the more agile they are, the better that they move, the better quality. A lot of these overuse injuries might go away. And so we're really excited about the program, and we're just actually starting. This week is our first, I guess, real. We've had a few pilot courses, and now this week, which I'm missing the beginning of, hope to be back on Friday, is our first kind of class that we're doing this with. So it's between 50 and 65 students per class. And so my primary responsibility is to, number one, be the athletic trainer of that unit, but also to impart that knowledge to the Marines so they can go out and teach that information and understand, you know, how do we look at injury prevention? And they're not going to have a J or a Ray there with them, so what can we give them? And not teaching them skills of assessment, but just teaching the concepts of prevention and maybe teaching them a couple tips and tricks of, you know, hey, look, this is something that needs to be evaluated by a medical professional. Or here's a couple things you can do to help with those knees that are caving in. Maybe here are some things that you may notice about your Marines as they're walking for 15 miles that, hey, those boots that are about 3 years old, they need to be changed for a reason. This is why. And I think that knowledge is going to go a lot further, and I think that's going to help prevent injuries down the line.
So you've been doing this for how long? How long have you been with the Marine Corps? How many years?
Over 10 years.
Okay. So for the audience, and you may not know this, but Jay is not just in the back of the pack with a Jeep and riding with a medical kit. He is on a, you know, 14, 20-hour walk-ruck mission with them, and he lives and breathes the understanding of what the demands are.
Well, I think it's really important.
And it leads to my question, is that in doing that, over that time period, what have you seen in terms of injury reduction and really specific, maybe a couple, like two or three specific areas that you have seen that the impact of, I'm not sure how many athletic trainers that work with the Marine Corps or the different bases, and maybe you can expand on that a little bit, how many you know of your colleagues are in that or in the other areas, but really what have you seen from an injury reduction and how that translates to, you know, us doing some things and how we practical application maybe for an athletic setting,
sure,
or a high school setting and doing using
one
skills.
One of the biggest changes that I've seen that relate to that is really a change in culture, because I've been there long enough to see what culture has changed. So when I started there, I was kind of regulated and kind of stuck in a clinic setting, meaning that I'm just catching injuries. I may be doing injury care every day, but in my head, I'm preventing injuries from getting worse, but I'm not really preventing injuries before coming in the door.
Yeah.
And so as being a part of the Marine Corps, going these hikes, you know, a lot of the prevention, funny enough, is just side conversations, is walking up and down the lines, being like, hey, Jay, I got this thing going on. And, you know, tell me, what can I do about this pain in the side of my knee? And it might be something simple like, you know, tendonitis. And just telling them a couple of things to do, foam roll, some stretching. I never see them again. And I'm assuming they've gotten better. But at the end of the day, when I started, those conversations didn't happen. And now I've seen things change drastically. For example, last summer was the first time I've seen an ice cooler full of ice in the field during their field exercises.
Yeah.
I'm like, what are these coolers doing? I said, well, every student's going to get a scoop of ice in their Camelback. Now, at the end of the day, you know, is that scoop of ice is really going to help them for the rest of the day? Maybe a little bit, but that wasn't even a thought in anybody's mind.
Yeah. They're not making snow cones.
Absolutely not. No, they're going to keep their Gatorade cold maybe in there, but for the students here, they're getting a scoop of ice in their Camelbacks to kind of help with hydration, you know, a little motivation for them, maybe cool their core temp down for a little bit, but certainly that was something that I have seen change over the years that I've been
so
there.
Even from the standpoint of the training at the Marine Corps training schools, I'm sure they've had a lot of that's transcended down to where you're seeing now, but also some of the other they're doing, say for example, functional movement screenings when they come in, changing how they wear their shoes, educating on the front side to have a better, healthier active force.
I think that came back to being with the Marines and being out there. And I know you joke, but yes, going out there with the guys, watching.
No, I mean, I was not joking. I mean, that's very serious. I mean, I want to emphasize to the audience that it's not, you know, I know there are a lot, there may be athletes trying to or looking, going to various military settings, and your wife is also an athlete, Anna, and has worked with the DEA Academy, correct?
Sure, yep.
And she sees that other side of law enforcement. We've got other, you know, Marine Corps, Navy, Army, those things. It's real. My point was, it's very important to understand what the demands are, really understanding the intricacies to get ownership. You got to be in the, you got to own what's being done, and that requires a very specialized area. I think it's an incredible area that you all are doing to keep our the folks who protect us on the forward front line and keeping the borders safe, that they're learning to do the best things, because you mentioned it a while ago, they may be out on a mission for several months, and they got to know how to eat the best they can to refuel themselves after a long mission or a daily mission or doing other types of activities. But even when they're on the downtime and what they're doing afterwards, it's no different than an athlete. It's an athlete that is a very highly functional, and they're good at what they do, and making sure they stay at their best level. When fatigue becomes a very predominant factor in making decisions that truly are life and death.
And, you know, I'm very lucky to be a part of that group and to help them out, but certainly I had to learn a lot. And I think that's where me doing understanding what they have to do on a daily job. So yeah. Just like any football player or any baseball player, I have to know what their job is. And I think we all grew up or got educated in that typical traditional athletic setting, and I think now we're in education, we've done better of getting our students out to different exposures and areas. But certainly I had to understand, you know, when they're talking about martial arts training, I had to understand what move they're talking about. I had to understand what field events they're doing. Because how can I make any recommendation if I hadn't been there or seen it or done a little bit of myself? And, you know, not to be confused of, hey, I'm doing it because I think it's fun. It's doing it to understand their job better. And in that culture, just like any competitive culture, they feed off that respect. You know, they like to see their docs, their foremen out there with them, hiking with them. And I think there is some shared camaraderie in pain and suffering, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where, you know, some of my best friends are from grad school. We all suffered together, you know, doing research, you know, getting up till, you know, 2-3 a.m. doing travel together. I mean, we're just a tight bonded group. And the military is to the nth degree of that. You know, these guys are trusting each other with their lives, and to be a part of that group and that brotherhood is very tight to gain that trust. And for me versus, you know, over 1,000 people or 1,000 Marines that I got to take care of in that population, I don't get that day-to-day interaction where they come in and see me all the time, unless they're being recycled for some reason. But I have to establish myself, my reputation, very quickly, very early on. I might see a patient for 5 treatments. But during that interview process, the assessment, I had better gained their trust, and I have better had their respect on the front end to get their information, because there's a very high tendency to hide injuries. Nobody wants to be weak. And nobody wants to be on anybody's radar, potentially to be dropped for training or any reason to be on any radars to get recycled for any reason. So, you know, their disclosure of their information is very confident. But between the command and the Marines and medical, the culture has changed where they're trusting. They understand it. Hey, for me to help you before you break, yeah, tell me some stuff. And that has been, that's been rewarding in itself, to say that, hey, I don't want to go tell this person, but I'll tell you. The secret is we're all on the same team on the medical side, but at the end of the day, they're willing to come to the athletic trainer first. And so that's been really exciting to see over the years.
And I think emphasize, you know, any, whether, and I've worked at a high school and obviously college work and other, you know, the settings, you're trying to do, athletic trainers are trying to do the best they can do to not see that person. And I mean that in a very sincere way. We want them to be healthy and want them to be there. You gave an excellent description of that, is you want them to be, they want to get well. They want to get well fast. They have to, it's a job there, but it's a passion they're doing as well. I mean, they have to be good at what they're doing, and you're trying to do so much things. You're doing a tremendous amount of work on the front side to, you're with them so much, but you don't want to see them when you have to see them. And I mean, if they do get hurt, you don't want to see that, but it does happen. So I guess I got a kind of a sidebar question came up. So what is the, in your years of working and doing and moving out, what's have you had any injuries that are that similar to the what's the if you don't mind sharing that,
I've been very fortunate. I haven't suffered any significant injury training with the guys. You know, I've had my tendonitis and overuse injuries here and there, and every once in a while I'll try to lift more weight than I should. But end of the day, you know, I try to be a good patient myself, and luckily I'm married to an athletic trainer, so she keeps on top of me for certain things. But no, I haven't suffered anything, knock on wood. But yeah. With this new Force Fitness program, I'll be maybe throwing around a little more weight and teaching a little bit more out in the field with strength training, conditioning. So as long as I follow my own advice, I think I'll be okay.
That's pretty good. That's great.
So if I could ask, being fairly new to, I'm not very experienced with athletic trainers working in the military. What does a traditional day for you consist of? What techniques or what tools are you able to take out in the field? Or are you able to work in more of a traditional athletic training room on a daily basis?
Sure. For me, I think if you do this podcast with any five athletic trainers, you get five different answers because the military experience is so different. So, for example, at Officer Canvas School, Jess Veracruz works over there, and it's like football every day, meaning that it's a go or no go. Game day is every single day, and if they get hurt too far, then they just go home. In contrast, where I work, they're already Marines, and so they get broke, we own them, so we do the long-term rehab with that. So at my location specifically, you know, from 6 till about 8, 9 o'clock, we'll do a sit call, which means anybody who has an injury from the day before or needs treatment before getting to class or the field, they'll come in. So even those that are in the fields for 4 or 5 days, sometimes they'll get bussed or trucked back in to get treatment for the morning, most likely not. But end of the day, we're just trying to manage that chaos in the morning, right? You open your doors at, you know, 3:15, 4 o'clock. You know, all these teams are coming in. Now, just imagine they're all coming in at once, and you're just triaging, assessing, rehabilitating those guys to get them in and get them out. Around 9:30 or so, you get a little transition time in there to kind of finish up your notes or to start your notes, depending on how bad the day is. And then you get kind of regular patients. So those that are trying to get back to training. So now they're done with physical therapy. They can walk. They're starting to run. Then they'll come see us. So not only getting back to ADLs, we'll let physical therapy do those things. Not that we can't, it's just that we have that service, and that's where we obviously leverage their time and their resources. We get them back to training, meaning that, okay, now we got to be more competitive. We got to make you that tactical athlete again. So there'll be a little bit of time maybe in the clinic and then upstairs in the gym doing more functional lifts. And then from 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock, you finish up and kind of go home. Depending on the day, depending on the week, you might be assigned 2, 3, just depends, field exercise things you might need to do. So maybe 1 week I got to go to the obstacle course, the endurance course. So I'll go there before training, get them ready. Who needs to get takes? Who needs to get rehab? Get them started. Go meet them in the barracks. Maybe even go out to the fields. Get a ride out there, drive my own car out there, take people up, see how training's going, make sure everything is safe as it needs to be. Catch some injuries if they need to, and then, you know, come back, break down for the day. There's some longer events, like a 15-mile hike is kind of a graduation requirement. So we'll be there all day, essentially. So we'll go out there, walk with the guys, you know, be in the back, you know, work with healing cases, you know, try to make sure that people are getting the care that they need, because the company's moving on regardless. They're doing a movement from point A to point B. So we're kind of helping and supplementing with the corpsman on the event, to help them, but also to provide those sports medicine services. So, typical day, typical week, kind of varies, but in my particular case right now, I'm switching over to that Force Fitness program. I think my role is going to change over to a little more of that course and that instruction, which is they're going to be exercising probably 2 to 3 times a day. They'll get a morning workout in, they'll get some classes, they'll do some practical application, so maybe it's TRX or some suspension training, and then they'll go back inside of the classroom. I'll come back outside for maybe another course of instruction or some other types of movements that we want to do. So that's going to look more traditionally like you're trying to train your strength conditioning coaches. Yes. And injuries are going to come from that, I'm sure. But until the program kind of grows a little bit more, I'm not quite sure how my new position is going to shake out. Might be a little more teaching, a little less field work, which is okay. But under the basic school in Quantico, I'll be one of those athletic trainers that can help in any of those capacities.
It's amazing. So the consistent theme seems to be with every athletic trainer that we talk to is every job situation is completely inconsistent. And everything is very traditional, or tremendously, I mean. Yet at the same time, there are many aspects of my job duties on a daily basis that you're doing the exact same thing with, and you're doing the exact same thing with. So that's an amazing part about this profession is that we can all be doing something completely different, but we have that core group of that core skill set that we're still doing the same thing.
And skill sets. I mean, and core and medical care skills. I mean, that's probably we have some commonalities. You know, your military setting. We talked, you know, like the emergency care type stuff. And I'm covering a race. I'm covering a military. You know, whether it's in the field or covering, you know, at a high school or college or at the Nissan plant in Canton, Mississippi that has athletic trainers. There's some things you have to know to be really good. And that particular, and I think Jay alluded to that. There's some things that he does well. He can do them, but it's working collaboratively with different groups and what you have to do to be really you just like you do at the high school. There's certain things you just don't have the opportunity. You can't do that in 24-hour period. It's not feasible. But do the things you're doing well. Know the things you're doing well, and continue to apply that. Be the best every day.
I think that's a testament to our education is that we all share those common things.
Yep.
An ankle sprain is an ankle sprain. Now, at the end of the day, you know, we might rehabilitate them just a little bit differently in their functional activities. But at the end of the day, I really tip my hat to the educators because at the end of the day, I want to hire the best athletic trainer. I could teach you the military stuff. I promise you can come over to my base. I'll show you the ropes. I'll show you how we sign in, maybe how we do things a little bit differently as far as flow. But I'd say within a month, I think you'd pick it up because we all share that education together. And I think it's adaptable. Some people adapt faster than others. I get that. But I really tip my hat to the educators of their changes. And even as I've been lucky enough to teach at George Mason, my language has changed. Instead of saying, well, you know, my football scenario, well, you're a factory worker or you're Marine or your sailor, whatever the case may be, just even changing my language differently when I'm teaching assessment or medical terminology, just not to the athlete anymore. And that's how I kind of grew up in my undergraduate.
I want to add to what you just said, you know, about from the education standpoint, the those athletic trainers that are supervising students in these programs, they're very, there's a lot of, and I always say this, there's a whole lot of athletic training that's not in a textbook that you have to learn in the field, and you have to learn how to do that. Now, and applying current best practices, and those students, they should be seeing it in the classroom and practicing it. And when they come out to a clinical, they should be doing the best thing. It should already be in place already, which is great. I mean, that's what in a healthcare profession, you're getting that crossover between the classroom, the lab. The classroom should be the live environment and where you're learning a lot. So that's, you know, I can talk all about a ACL injury, and I can simulate it all I want to, but until you actually see your first ACL and you evaluate it, everybody who knows ACL, like, okay, I remember exactly how what you felt in your stomach, and when you did that, you know, the Lottman's test or other type of injury, like, okay, I now remember that. So those are things that are kind of it's an endurable teaching moment. So I'm glad you mentioned that because I think it's really important that they. Seeing best practices and applying best practices, regardless of the setting.
So coming out of my undergrad, I went, like many of us have done, I worked as a graduate assistant, and then was just kind of thrust into the secondary school setting, and was the head athletic trainer at a large school here in Texas. My assistant at the time was a first-year athletic trainer as well, so we were just completely thrown to the wolves. What we had to do was figure out, at that point in time, what worked for our setting. On the fly, and I've said before, about 10% of what I do on a daily basis is what I learned as an undergrad and in grad school. About 90% of what I do is what I've had to figure out on the go. So
on the job training,
absolutely. We were speaking with Sandy Miller earlier, and he said that I asked him what's the biggest change he's seen through his career in our profession, and he said the biggest change that he's seen is the education system and how it's grown and evolved, and you know. 30, 40, 50 years ago, we were putting out a completely different athletic trainer than we're putting out now. And not to say that 50 years ago we weren't putting out great athletic trainers, But we've evolved. We've changed. Our job description and our profession has changed.
And, you know, patients, I mean, the public wants some, it's technology's changed. Physicians need that as well. They've asked a lot about, you know, what that is. So it's grown over time, and it's going to continue to grow, not just for athletic training, but for, you know, physicians, for PAs, PTs, OTs, nutritionists, or, you know, registered dietitians, social workers. They're all the expectation is it's parallel across all of those. We're all having they're experiencing the same things, and just in different contexts, though. So it's been. We got to get going. I know,
yeah,
I've got to go. We got to get going to other stuff. We got, you know, the NATA in Houston here, and it's always enjoy. I've been on the Sports Medicine Podcast before with Jeremy before, and it's been a blast. I know that Jay is he listens to it when I asked him about coming on board, and us kind of chewing the fat.
I'm excited. Yeah, this was a complete honor and unexpected privilege to be here, and thanks for having me on. I really do appreciate it.
And I've got a couple podcasts going on right now. One, here's the Frio Hydration, and then the other one is over at Dragonfly. Is that right? They're doing some stuff. That's cool. We're doing that.
Jeremy's setting up the one over at Dragonfly. He asked me a few days ago if I would just come up and help him out here. So. I do not do this for a living.
You're getting peanuts, aren't you?
Press this button and try not to sink home.
Okay.
So, I did a
that's
great
pretty
job.
Good job.
I think you did a great service for
thank
all of us.
Thank you all so much for running this. I felt like the third wheel. Thank you. Y'all did such an awesome job, so I really want to appreciate it.
Oh, it's fantastic. So, Jay, if someone's interested in more information about, I'm going to ask about wanting to get in the Marine Corps, could they contact you? And if so, I know they put it on the information on the website. Is that correct? On the podcast. Is that,
yes,
Jeremy
right.
does that. So okay, we'll have it on there.
We'll have it on
there. On their contact information, and same for me as well. And this has been great. We get to go. Now we get to go to learn. I've learned tremendously, you know, get to listen to you and John both, you know, we're just having a fun dialogue, get to learn more. And I see Jay a good bit, but still learn something new today. And questions you asked made me think about what, you know, things to do better, and it's been a blast. And we get to do some more learning for the next couple of days, and get to see friends and colleagues, and this is just a great. I'm glad y'all are doing this. First time I think we've seen this done at NATA, I think, doing a podcast. So I appreciate everything you, Jeremy, and everybody else at the Sports Medicine Podcast does in sharing knowledge.
Well, thank you all again for being here, and we'll sign off on this session now.
Great, thank you.
You.